Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is former president of EMI Records, Rupert Perry. But first, let's talk about Apple Music and the latest uproar over the trial period that they have. Of course, there's a 90-day trial period for consumers to try out the service where they don't have to pay anything. And during the initial announcement, Apple said that they were not going to pay artists and record labels and songwriters as a result. Well, this didn't sit well, especially with indie labels. There may be a different deal with the major labels, but we're not privy to that information. So as a result, indie labels raised an uproar over everything, but it really came to a head last week when Taylor Swift basically wrote an open letter saying that it was wrong. She wasn't going to provide any of her catalog, if that was the case, on the free tier. And basically, Apple backed down, surprisingly enough. They backed down and they agreed to pay on all of the streams for the free trial period. And what that amounts to is 0.2 cents for every stream. And that's about exactly what Spotify pays on its free tier as well. It's sort of an industry average, because on streams, the only way that you could figure out how much each stream is paying is by an average. And the reason why is streaming pays differently for different services, and it pays differently for different tiers. The free tier pays a lot less than the paid tier, and different countries pay different royalty rates. So the only way you could calculate it is by kind of a rough average. So the rough average here is 0.2 cents for the free tier. But it's kind of cool that Apple did that. Now, really, Apple had good and bad in this situation. It could have stood firm and not paid anything during that trial period. But the problem with that is that you don't really want a negative going into a big launch, which is going to happen anytime now. And the fact of the matter is, there was actually a lot of good publicity in that it kept the story going for a week longer than it would have otherwise. So this worked to Apple's favor as well. Apple Music, we're talking about. So anyway, it looks like everybody's going to be happy, at least on some level, and we all await the big launch. Now, in other news, Google Play also launched a free tier. It's ad-supported, just like Pandora and iTunes Radio, and basically features curated playlists. Up until now, you had to pay for Google Play. It was $9.95 a month, and for that, you got a huge catalog, and I don't know that it's any different from anybody else's, but in order to stay in the game against Apple Music, they had to come out with a free tier as well, which they did. So it should be interesting to see what happens in the coming months when Google will also launch YouTube Music Key. And that's really when the streaming wars will get interesting. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program. It's 101 mixing tricks, big studio tricks for the small studio. Go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. The next thing in the news this last week was the truth about Beats headphones. Those of us in the studio business have always complained about the sound of Beats being hyped on the low end and not being a particularly good quality headphone, or at least compared to what we're used to. That being said, they have become kind of a standard. If you go to a gym, that's all you see, and they've really taken the world by storm. Well, a website called PopMech did a teardown of the most popular Beats headphones, which is the Solo model. And what they found was that, contrary to the marketing of Beats, the components were the cheapest off-the-shelf components that you can get. What made it even worse is the fact that everything was glued together, so they're very fragile, and on good quality headphones, you'll find that they're actually screwed together and they really feel a lot better. The thing that was the most interesting about this, though, is the fact that you always know if you have a cheap pair of headphones because you pick them up and they feel really light. And in order for Beats to overcome this, they actually put weights in the headphones. There's four weights that add about 30% more weight. And this made it feel substantial. And as a result, you got the feeling that you had a quality product when in fact you really don't. So I would suggest that if you really like Beats phones, yes, continue to use them and feel good about it. But if you're thinking about a new set of headphones to buy, go look at the AKGs or the Audio Technicas or the Sennheisers or the Beyers or any other really good high quality pair and compare them first and see what you like after that. My guest Rupert Perry held several executive positions at EMI, including Vice President of A&R at Capital, President of EMI America, the UK, and Europe during his more than 30 years in the business. He was also chairman of both the British Phonograph Industries and IFPI trade groups. Rupert was also named a CBE, or Commander of the British Empire, for his service to the British music industry. That's one step below knighthood, by the way. I spoke with Rupert from his home in the Hollywood Hills. So Rupert, thanks so much for being with me today. I've been waiting for this for a long time.
Well, I hope it'll be worthwhile, Bobby.
When we talked, in an interview that I did with you for one of my books a year or two ago, you told me the story about when you first got the job at EMI, which was really interesting. Could you tell us what that was, please?
Oh, gosh. Well, of course, I can't quite remember the story now, but I think it was along the lines of that. I suppose what I was reflecting on was that in those days, this was 1970, okay? And I think any of us then at that time were trying to get into the record business or even the music publishing business. You know, there was no sort of exact route to it. You kind of fell into it one way or the other. In my case, I'd been a failed musician, and then I'd found out that there was a business. There was a business of music. I mean, to me, back in those times in the 60s, late 60s, I didn't really realize there was a business to music. And when I found that out, I thought, wow, that's wonderful. That sounds great. And if I could get a job in this music business, wouldn't that be wonderful? And I ended up getting a job in the music publishing company. And then when I went for my job interview at EMI, of course, they kind of look down the nose a bit at me and say, well, you know, we want people that have record company experience as opposed to music publishing experience. But in the end, I must have won the day because they called me back for a second interview and I got the job. I suppose the other funny thing about that story at that time was that when I got the job at EMI, which was, as I said, late 1970, 71, one of the executives said to me, he said, well, of course, you're going to be working for this person whose name was L.G. Wood. L.G. Wood was the main board director of EMI in charge of music worldwide. And I was going to have a job being his sort of, you know, gopher, run around, etc. And they said to me, they said, by the way, this job, do you have a problem because it is required that you wear a suit and tie every day?
Back then in 1970, huh?
Yeah. So I put my suit and tie on every day, and it was an amazing experience and a great learning experience. But I suppose, Bobby, the point that I'm making is that I find today it's quite fascinating today that there are so many universities and colleges now running what we would term a music business course or program, and you can get degrees in the music business. And I find that fascinating, and I think that's very good. I think that's very healthy. The sort of degrees that you got for the music business in those days in the 70s were like, you know, either you went to law school or you went to accountancy and you got a degree in accountancy or law, and that was another way that you got into what has now become the music business.
But isn't there a problem with too many people with degrees? And I mean, in recording, it's the same thing. There are so many people that come out of, you know, just about any university because there's a recording program and there's not enough work for them.
Yeah, that may be, you may well be right there. But I also found it fascinating. I was talking to a class at Syracuse University where you know, from time to time, I help them with their music business program. And we had a class of about 25 students who were then graduating that year. And the question which was posed to them, you know, please put up your hands, who's going to join a record company? And the very few hands went up. But what was interesting to me, it was the variety of different avenues and, that they were going down, and the different jobs they'd kind of lined up for when they graduated from Syracuse that they were going to go and do. Now, of course, as we all know, we all start off going in one direction like that, and then, you know, things change, and you go down a left turn or a right turn, and you end up doing something completely different. But I was fascinated at the entrepreneurialism of what that particular graduating class was going to do.
You know, it's funny because it's one of the failings, I think, of so many of the universities that teach programs like this, is that they teach you how to get a job and not how to be an entrepreneur, when the fact of the matter is just about everybody in the music business is an entrepreneur, at least at one point in time or another. You have to be, you know, you make your own job many times.
Yes. I'm not quite certain how you teach entrepreneurialism. I think we look at the people that have been entrepreneurs and successful entrepreneurs. I think it's something in their makeup. There's something that has that drive. When you read about these people, not necessarily in the music industry, across all sorts of industries, they all sort of have a certain drive about them that makes them that way. And that drive and that inquisitiveness of wanting to find out or wanting to succeed or wanting to figure out how they're going to get their idea off the ground. And I think that's a different sort of person than somebody who qualifies with a law degree and joins a big legal firm and then, say, specializes in legal copyright or something like that.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Definitely. As a matter of fact, if there is one place where you could find a traditional job, it's with, you know, major publishers or major record labels, but I think everybody else is kind of on the entrepreneur side. I'm curious about the students that you talked to in that particular class. Were they, what did they seem to want to do?
They were going to do a variety of things. Some were going to go into publishing. Some were going to go into concert promotion, club promotion. Some were going to go into merchandising. They had some merchandising ideas. It was a broad range of ideas across, you know, a wide spectrum of what we would describe as, in quotes, the music industry. And in fact, when we look at the music industry today, it is very wide and a very broad spectrum of different areas, different buckets, different silos of you know, what happens. And I suppose that's, you know, here again, if you feel you've found a niche and you've found a way that you want to get into it, great, good for you. I mean, we all still have to, in quotes, kind of get into it. We all had to get into it one way or another. You as a musician, me as a quasi-music publishing executive, not knowing anything about music publishing when I started in music publishing, and then, you know, when I kind of moved on to EMI, I had a little knowledge about music publishing. But I think it's always that thing of, you know, where do you find the entrance point? Here again, that's down to the hustle. And I always say that when you're starting off, you know, we all hustled for gigs, we hustled for whatever, the foot in the door syndrome. It all comes down to that, as opposed to, you know, having a law degree or an accountancy degree and getting a job in the uh, you know, the accountancy department of a large media company or a large large law firm.
I want to go back to when you were at EMI for a second. Were you ever tempted to leave? Or did you leave at one time and come back?
No, I joined EMI in the UK, and I always, I quickly figured, I don't know how I managed to do this, but I quickly figured that from a music point of view, that a lot was, you know, a lot of what was then the worldwide record music publishing business was dominated by what happened in the United States. And so I always had this desire of wanting to go to the United States to sort of see what I could find out. And very luckily for me, I got that opportunity a couple of years after I'd been at EMI in London. And so I had that opportunity to come and work in Los Angeles at Capitol Records. And so I grabbed that opportunity, and that brought me here. Ironically, I never... I moved around. I mean, I spent 15 years in the United States at Capitol Records. I then went to Australia for a bit, and then I ended up back in the UK and Europe for EMI. It was always an EMI connection. So in total, I spent 30 plus years in the world of what you could call EMI records worldwide.
How do you feel about it today, now that it's part of Universal? What do you think about that?
Well, it's very sad. It's both part of Universal, and other parts of it are part of Warner.
Yeah.
So it kind of got divided up between the two, between Warner and Universal. In that respect, it's very sad. I can understand why it became that way. And sometimes you just got to move on. You have to keep moving on. You know, yes, we can reflect on the history and we can talk about the history. EMI was a company that was started originally in 1897. So it was a company that was over 100 years old. It had over 100 years worth of history in the recorded music and latterly in the music publishing area. So it's got the most wonderful history to it. But unfortunately it came to an end, and it got divvied up, and that's what's happened. So you kind of move on from there.
What was it like when Thorne owned it? Did that change your operating procedure at all?
Well, I think that it had been part of this, you know, when, yes, it did a bit, because when Thorne came in in the late 70s, early 80s, the Thorne people were, you know, didn't necessarily understand entertainment, had not had any experience in the entertainment or the music business. But they came in and they set to, and they started to manage the company. I mean, along the way, there was always some speculation that maybe, in quotes, they might sell off music. But ironically, it never, ever happened. And I don't know, maybe EMI Music, if it had been sold off, it might be still surviving today. But it was never sold off under the Thorne regime. But then after a while, what happens with these things, you know, they get used to, okay, here's music, it's delivering this, you know, this revenue, it's delivering this bottom line to us. Oh, that's pretty good, you know. So, I mean, yes, there were some opportunities that were missed because the Thorne people didn't quite understand and appreciate the business. And when somebody like that initially comes in, they're leery about taking what they deem to be risks. they want to kind of see how it's going to evolve, etc., before they start taking risks.
I guess you can't blame them in a way, because it's so different than, well, in their case, it was, you know, electronics that they were doing, and it's different. You make a product and you kind of know at least what it's going to sell in a ballpark, and you never know that in the music business.
Yeah, I mean, that was the thing. They were people, they were used to factories, they were used to, they made light bulbs. They understood that, and they were very successful at that. But the irony of it was, is that as time went on, and it was interesting because if you think about it, you move on to the late 80s, early 90s, what was the sort of mantra for large companies was to have global. They were talking about global businesses. They were talking about internationalizing their businesses. And the irony of it was, is that in the portfolio of businesses that made up Thorn EMI in the early 90s, the one business that they had that was truly a global business was the music business. All the other businesses they had, even though they were extremely successful in certain parts of the world, they didn't really have that globalization that EMI had. And the reason that EMI had that globalization was, if you go back in the history to the early 1900s of EMI, that's when, if you want, the A&R men or A&R entrepreneurs of their day went off to all these different parts of the world with their recording equipment to make local recordings. So in the world of EMI, we can see companies in Russia, in India, in Latin America that were all started by these EMI people back in those days, in the early 1900s.
That's pretty interesting, actually. I never considered that, but you're right. That's the way that worked.
Yeah. Yeah.
What was the...
We had a company, EMI had a company started in Russia in 1904.
No kidding.
Very strange to think about that. EMI also had a company in China in the 1920s and in the 1930s.
Wow. I had no idea.
Yeah. And what was interesting about it is those particular countries didn't have, in quotes, the recording equipment that EMI had coming from its base in London. And so if you were an A&R man of the day, you would organize and ship your microphones and your recording equipment to these far-flung places. You would find whoever the local star was of the day, and then you'd make a recording.
Yeah. And it must have worked, obviously.
Yeah, it did.
But I guess that's why EMI had studios everywhere in Johannesburg, right? And Paris.
When it came to that moment of, okay, so then some of the local companies said, well, okay, we don't need, I presume, I don't know, I wasn't alive in those days, but I presume they said, we don't need the man from London with the microphones and recording equipment to come out here because we've now got some of our own. And so, yes, we ended up having studios, recording studios, all over the place.
Wow. What was your best memory of your time at EMI?
Oh, I don't know if I got a best memory because you end up having so many memories, I don't know what a best memory is. Lots of different memories.
Is there anything that stands out as something particularly cool?
Well, I suppose here's a memory. And mainly because I was just there the other night. I was at the Hollywood Bowl the other night, and I was reflecting on when I went to the Hollywood Bowl in 1973 to see Pink Floyd perform Dark Side of the Moon. Pink Floyd at the Hollywood Bowl performing Dark Side of the Moon in 1973 was absolutely magical.
Oh, I guess they had the big quad system up, and the, right. There was a show they that had, nobody else had at the time. Yeah.
Yeah, they had the show. They had that, you know, the famous heartbeat at the start of the show going around the bowl. You know, they had the airplane crashing. What else? They bathed. They had the spotlights at the back. They got spotlights at the back of the bowl, bathed it in this pink glow. And then I think they ended up with a firework display at the end. I think it was done by the Disney people.
Wow. Yeah, that's something I remember.
You know, so that's, you know, but that's, you know, yeah, you tend to reflect on these things when something, you know, you're in the present. You know.
What was the most difficult thing you had to do while you were there? The job that you disliked the most?
The job I disliked the most was, you know, probably having to let people go. I have to tell people, I'm sorry, we're closing this, or we're changing this. And I think that's always the same for any of these businesses. That's the worst one.
Yeah. No, it makes sense.
Another one is actually having to admit to an artist that, you know, it didn't happen. The recording, you know, you spent, you know, whatever it is, you spent God knows how many months, years of your life writing these songs. We've gone in the studio, we've made the record, we've put the record out, and it didn't happen.
Yeah.
And it's like, sorry, we're not going to pick up the option. We're not going to make another album. I mean, that's tough, because you want to succeed. You want to have success. There's nothing like having that moment of celebrating a successful recording, or certainly in our case, a recording, and then a successful performance by an artist. That's fantastic. That's a fantastic moment. But the downside of it is telling them, hey, sorry, we're going to let you go.
But that moment is different today, isn't it? Because you could you could celebrate a gold record or a platinum record or a diamond or whatever, but you don't really have those same goals, those same levels as you used to now. I mean, you still have them, but they're reached a lot, you know, less than they were, you know, way back then.
Yeah. I don't know, because I'm, you know, as you know, I haven't been in that sort of, you know, but I still think there's this moment. I mean, I was lucky enough last September. I was lucky enough that I was able to go with a former colleague to see Kate Bush perform in Hammersmith in London. What a magical moment that was.
Wow.
You know, if you've been in the business and you've seen all these wonderful performances, you still see things today and you hear things and you say, oh, wow, that's truly, truly amazing. That is truly, truly unique. And that's what we kind of felt after we'd seen Kate Bush that night, is that was quite an amazing performance, especially because for my colleague and I, we had been involved with her off and on over so many years.
She never really had the success that everybody expected of her, right?
Not on the scale that other people, other artists did. But I think that in some ways was kind of her own choosing. I mean, she did very early on in her career, she performed and then she stopped performing. And then until last year.
Yeah, that's right. It's been a long time.
And it was a long time. So yes. But I think this success that is in numbers, and then there's critical success. Yes, we can talk about huge numbers, and then we can talk about, as I said, critical success. I think when it comes to critical success and uniqueness, she's way up there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But yeah. Really, that's what you're striving to get, artists like that on your label, right?
Yes. Well, I mean, in that case, it was Dave Gilmore from Pink Floyd.
Really? Oh, yeah. I didn't really know that. Wow.
Yes. Yeah.
So he brought Kate to you.
He brought Kate to EMI.
Yeah. Wow. Wow.
He brought Kate to EMI, and she was, I've forgotten how old she was. She was like 16, 17.
Mm, yeah, young.
And he, yeah. No, that was Dave Gilmore.
Jumping to the current music business that we're in, what do you think the fix is for the music business today? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I don't know that there's a fix. I think that you've got to keep moving along. You've got to keep going with the evolution, because there is an evolution that's driven by technology that is happening, and that's going to continue to happen. And I think you just got to have your eyes and ears open, and be prepared to be more risk taking than maybe we were at the start of when the internet first appeared. And I think that's what it is. That's what if I've learned anything, is that, you know, you need to be, you know, really aware of who's doing what, what's going on, and make sure that you're looking at absolutely everything. And out of that may come a fix. But then let's think about the fix. What is the fix? The fix is okay. Is it about building the revenues back up again, the worldwide revenues, that, you know, of a business that has halved its revenue base, both here in the United States and also in other parts of the world? Is that what the fix is? So if you can build the revenue base up further, that would mean that recording artists and songwriters would have the benefit of hopefully getting a bigger share of a bigger revenue base. That's probably what the fix is. Now, how that happens, well, that's a constant, as I say, that's constantly evolving. And I think that you've just got to be open and aware of it. And, you know, we had the Apple announcement a couple of weeks ago. Okay, that's another evolving situation. And hopefully that will mean that revenues will start to increase.
Yeah, they think they're going to get to 100 million subscribers fairly quickly. And that would change everything considerably, because all of a sudden there'd be a lot of money coming in every month that you can pretty much count on. And then, of course, we have YouTube coming in, YouTube Music Key.
Yep.
So that will monetize some of that. And I think that Amazon is going to do something with Amazon Prime, because they don't say how many subscribers they have already, but they have quite a number of them, and they have a big catalog of music that you can get to as well. So it looks like there's a lot of opportunities for the revenue to grow, don't you think?
Yes, I think there's a lot of opportunities, and I think that's what the, you know, when you say what's the fix, I think it's okay. Are these big worldwide companies that dominate the world now? Are those companies going to be the road to hopefully increase revenues, and then the knock-on effect of that in relation to the copyright owners, whoever they might be, and the artists and songwriters.
What do you think about publishing these days? Is publishing as valuable as it used to be, considering the way label revenues have dropped?
Yeah, I think so. You know, it's interesting that the there are a lot of new entrants into the publishing world, mainly by investing large sums of money in buying up publishing rights. So there have been quite a few new entrants. There are the existing players who are, you know, I think doing and continue to do well. Yes, there are issues about, you know, you know, how do you divvy up the pie these days, and, you know, should they get more? Yes, there are issues about the performing rights organizations, but I think publishing it continues to do well. I mean, the interesting thing, of course, we always used to say, with all due respect to the publishers, and even the publishers would say this themselves, they would always say, well, we're a couple of cents business, a penny business. Well, the interesting thing about that, of course, is that what has evolved in the digital space is, of course, that the recorded music business has become a 1 cent, 2 cent, you know, penny type business as well. So in that respect, the recorded side has sort of, you know, come onto the same level as the publishing side.
Yeah, pretty interesting, huh? It's pretty much the same as far as that's concerned, at least
and
for now.
Certainly in the digital space. Obviously, the physical space, which still continues, it's a very different ratio. But in the digital space, it's you're in a penny's business.
But the physical space is still substantial, and it seems like everyone is overlooking that because there is, 170-some million CDs sold last year in the U.S., and that's what we could count. That, you know, there's probably another 50 million or something that we never counted. So it's still substantial. It's not going to grow, but it's not dying as quickly as everyone thought, I think.
Yes, and of course that is yes. I mean, it's going to continue to be there. And you know, we do sometimes tend to get all totally focused on what's going on in the digital space, and until we read an announcement that you know physical sales were this or that. We tend to sort of forget that physical sales do continue.
What do you think about changing the release day?
Well, changing the release day, I think that was long overdue. But
you do, yeah. Really?
Well, I think the release date issue was always a complicated thing, and especially when we started to have to try and release things on the same, in quotes, on the same day.
You're talking about different territories.
In different territories, yes. Yeah. I mean, we had same day release dates in 20 years ago in EMI, that we would put something out and we would, you know, we would release, we'd have a game plan to how we would release, one of our big recordings on virtually the same day.
See, to me, they picked the wrong.
Certainly, everywhere around the world, there might be a you know, because of the U.S. mainly the U.S. is driven by the geographical size of the U.S. When you think of most other countries of the world, you can release something and you can get it to every place you need to in 5 or 6 hours one morning. Well, you can't do that in the United States or Canada, mainly because of the geographical size. And then you also have the different, you had in those days, the different elements of, rack jobbers and people like that, and how they wanted to do things. But certainly in the rest of the world, we always used to have, we'd have same day release.
See, I think personally that they chose the wrong day though, because it used to be Tuesday, now it's Friday. But to me, if you're going to promote something, Tuesday's the best day of the week, because as far as a news day, it's usually the quietest. It's after, you know, Monday is crazy usually, and then the noise of the week just grows after Tuesday. So it seemed to me that Tuesday would have been better than Friday.
Yeah, yeah. And then you would hear all the arguments about why, in other parts of the world, Tuesday was not a good day.
Yeah,
well, for whatever reason.
Sure.
You know, because, you know, people would get driven by, radio programmers when they announce their new playlist for what week, when what day they did that. You get driven by, you know, major TV shows, okay?
Yeah, okay.
In our case in the UK, Top of the Pops went out on a Thursday at 7 o'clock, 7:30. So, you know, all of these things would have, you know, would kind of have a different knock-on effect in relation to release dates. But those things started to change when we got into more of instead of sort of distribution being country-specific, it became region-specific. By that, I mean, you know, we'd hit a button in Europe and everybody get that, in quotes, that album, that record, that day.
Yeah, yeah. Last question for you. What's the best piece of business advice that someone either imparted to you or that you learned over the course of your career?
Ooh. Best piece of business advice. Gosh, I wish you'd have told me that. I suppose the thing that I've said this, I suppose it comes down to, and this applies especially in the creative business, where you're dealing with creative people, what you have to establish, and this takes a lot of doing, is that you have to establish trust. And you know, you need to build that trust with creative people. And at the same time, if you're operating, you know, if you're operating a company, small, medium, whatever, you have people that are working for you and that are looking at you, and you have to kind of create a form of trust with them.
Yeah.
Because it's like, hey, I'm making a decision here. Follow me.
Yeah, sure.
You know, follow me. It's that. I've always thought it's very important. Certainly, dealing with artists, dealing with their managers, dealing with their lawyers, dealing with their agents. You've gotta build a trust so that you can build a working trust together to get to the ultimate aim, which is, you know, what everybody wants, which is that success.
Rupert, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you, Bobby.
Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. He helps put the show together. Thank you very much, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski, and I'll see you next time.